I'm delighted to welcome to This Irish American Life, Chris Gilligan. Chris is here with us by way of the University of the West of Scotland, the School of Media, Culture and Society. And am I correct in saying, Chris, that this is your most recent publication? Yes, your most recent book.
Most recent, yes.
And it's called Northern Ireland and the Crisis of Anti-Racism, Rethinking Racism and Sectarianism. First of all, Chris, welcome to Glucksman Ireland House. This is your first time here with us.
That's right, yes. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're delighted to welcome you here, and thanks for taking time out on your trip to join us here on This Irish American Life so we can share some of your insights based on the research for this book with our audience. Maybe by way of background and for the uninitiated, will you tell us a little bit about your background, Chris, and what led to this book?
Do you mean like where I grew up, or
or your scholarly work prior, or whatever? Did this book come about?
Right. Well, the book came about initially because I thought it was going to be an easy book to write because I was at the University of Ulster, teaching at the University of Ulster for 7 years, from 2000 to 2007. And it was a time when there was a lot of change going on in Northern Ireland. And one of the changes that was taking place was significant migration into Northern Ireland, where there hadn't been during the Troubles. There hadn't really been much during the peace process. But after, in the 2000s, there was beginnings of migration and significant numbers of migrants coming to Northern Ireland. So I did a bit of work around that when I was at the University of Ulster. Brought out reports on the attitudes of political parties and politicians to migrants. Did that work with Aidan McGarry and Paul Hainsworth. Did some work on public attitudes towards migrants. And I'd done that work, and I'd also done work on the peace process and conflict and coming out of conflict, and I thought it would be just a simple matter of combining those two things together in a book to talk about racism and sectarianism, and then discovered that I'd done the same thing as I was criticising other people for not doing, which is thinking about racism and sectarianism together, whereas I'd done what virtually everybody else had done, which was compartmentalise them and treat them as if they're entirely separate things. So the book turned out to not be an easy write, because it meant I had to rethink a whole lot of how we think about sectarianism and how we think about racism.
So was there, Chris, a eureka moment in terms of, was there an incident or was there something you read, or what was that kind of light bulb moment in terms of you saying, hold on a second? And I mean, I think that as a scholar, the sign of a mature and self-reflective scholar is someone who can say, oh shoot, you know, I was coming at that wrongly. Can you pinpoint an actual moment where you kind of thought to yourself, oh my God, I've been looking at this wrong, this isn't the right way to do it? Or was it slower build?
It was more, yes, it's more of a slow process. So there are some people who have written about racism and sectarianism. I can count them on one hand, and they don't even need my thumb to do it. Robbie McVeigh is one person who's done that, and Bill Rolston. They're two people I find really useful for helping to think through racism and sectarianism. But neither of them have done book-length work on it, so that was my challenge, to try and take what some of the insights they had and develop that further.
Can I ask you a basic thing, Chris? Can you define what you mean by racism and sectarianism when you're talking about Northern Ireland? Because I'm conscious of the fact that we've American listeners listening in here to us, and those words and that those kind of definitions change over time and space, right? So could you give it, like, not to get too into the weeds in terms of like terminology or typologies or whatever, but what do we mean when we say racism and sectarianism in the context of Northern Ireland?
Well, I think that's a great question, because that's key to the book, really. And one of my motivations for writing the book was I was very unhappy with the way that racism was being talked about in Northern Ireland, and the standard text that were the reference texts on racism in Northern Ireland, because what they do is they differentiate between racism and sectarianism and say racism is about colour as a marker of difference, and sectarianism is about religion as a marker of difference. And I think that's really problematic in all sorts of ways, because it makes the people who are the victims of racism the defining feature of racism, rather than looking at structures or processes. So when you say about what do we mean by racism, because it varies in different contexts, I think that's absolutely crucial. So part of what the book is about is an excavation of the construction of racism as something different from sectarianism in Northern Ireland. And when you start to go back and look at it, you realise that it's not a pre-given that sectarianism and racism would be seen as something different. So you look at the 19th century, for example, there's a remarkable speech by Douglas Hyde on the de-Anglicising of Ireland.
Mm-hmm, famous speech.
Yeah, and there's the term ethnicity wasn't being used at the time. Race was and nation was. The two terms in that speech are used interchangeably in lots of ways. The notion of race and nation as involving blood is in there, as involving culture is in there. So the idea that race is something that was about biology is something that's more from the 1930s. You start to realise when you look back at it, and that at the end of the 19th century race was being thought of in terms of culture and blood, and not necessarily colour at all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I found that actually in my own research on the early 20th century, Chris, these, you know, references to the Irish race, you know, a term that we wouldn't really be used to in the more recent period, but I think it's speaking exactly to your point.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's not just then as well. You look at the 1960s in Northern Ireland, and when the civil rights movement was starting up, they drew parallels between what they were doing and what was happening in the southern states in the US with the civil rights movement in the US. And so saying that it's about the situation we're in, the circumstance we're in, the facing of discrimination, systematic discrimination of Catholics in Northern Ireland, drawing parallels between that and blacks in the US. So there's a sense there that what we're experiencing is parallel to racism in the US. And then I started to look at why is it that racism is seen to be something different from sectarianism? And you find that in the UK race relations law, that developed in parallel with immigration law, so restrictions on immigration in the 1960s. And the 1963 Immigration Act, when that was being discussed in Parliament, there were a number of MPs that were saying, in my constituency, it's the Irish that are the problem. We need to be restricting the Irish. We don't have a problem with immigrants from the Caribbean or from South Asia. It's the Irish immigrants who really are the problem in my constituency. So the Irish were being talked about as immigrants and as a problem in alongside the discussions that are taking place where people from the Caribbean and from South Asia are being talked about as immigrants and a problem and the need to control immigration. And the Irish aren't brought into the Immigration Act as a category of people that there need to be restrictions on. And one of the rationales that's given for that is that the border in Ireland means that it's just not going to be practical to be able to enforce immigration controls in Ireland. Which, in the context of Brexit, you think the issue of the Irish border and movement between Ireland and the UK is something that people should have been more aware of, given that the history that's there. But that means that when the Immigration Acts come in, they're criticised by some people as this is just an explicit colour bar. Whereas if the Irish had been included in that, the Acts would have been looked at differently. And the issue of immigration would have been looked at differently.
So you don't think it was a colour bar, based on your research, Chris?
It came to operate as a colour bar. Certainly,
you don't think it was conceived as such?
Well, I think certainly some people, yes, that was the way they thought of it. So what I'm saying is that the retrospective narrative cuts out the complicating factors and makes it seem like it was a seamless, clear-cut process, when in fact it wasn't, when you go back and look at the historical record. And then the other thing that happened that reinforced that is when the Race Relations Act was being discussed in Parliament, the 1965 Race Relations Act, the Stormont government said to Westminster, we want Northern Ireland to be excluded from the Race Relations Act. And this is at a time where the very early stages of the civil rights movement, and it seems to be the concern of the Stormont government is that if you bring in a law that restricts discrimination on the basis of race, colour, ethnicity, then this, and this is applied throughout the UK, it's a law there that Catholics can use for redress against government in Northern Ireland, a sectarian government, a Protestant parliament for a Protestant people, so with systematic discrimination against Catholics. And so they successfully lobbied to have Northern Ireland excluded from the remit of the Race Relations Act. But not only that, they lobbied to have religion not be one of the criteria for discrimination under the Race Relations Act. Although you had some Jewish groups lobbying to have religion included, and the Northern Irish government was successful in excluding religion from the criteria of grounds for racial discrimination. And again, that's because of the concern about what would happen if this is included in the Race Relations Act, because it could very just easily be picked up to talk about what's happening in Northern Ireland, systematic discrimination against Catholics. So what seems like something that is a race relations issue about colour, and that's the way in which British race relations develops, thinking in those terms, is in part a consequence of Northern Ireland and the way that Northern Ireland relates to the rest of the UK. So there's that construction that made race relations appear the way it is. And one of the things that I thought when I was starting to look at racism in Northern Ireland, I thought there's real problems with British race relations law and anti-racist activity. So that's why the book's called Northern Ireland and the Crisis of Anti-Racism, because anti-racist activity is implicitly and historically based on the notion of racism is about colour. It's against people of colour. But in the UK today, two of the major forms of racism are xenophobia against white, Polish and other East European immigrants, and that was a significant part of the Brexit vote, the Leave vote, and Islamophobia. Discrimination on religious grounds, or people who are identified on religious grounds. And when you look at it in those terms, then it seems like Northern Ireland is not this exceptional thing. Northern Ireland is an insight into the future of what race relations will become in the United Kingdom, so Northern Ireland in the 1960s, is an insight into what race relations will become later. But the law doesn't change. But the way in which people think about racism, I think, is it's very confused because of the way that the categories of racism developed in the context of the UK.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So I'm, in part, the book's not written really for a Northern Irish audience. I mean, in part, it certainly is, and there's lots of, that is the focus of the book. But in part, the book is written for a UK audience to say, like, scholars of racism and anti-racism in the UK, racist and anti-racist, or anti-racist activists in the UK, you should look at Northern Ireland and take Northern Ireland more seriously in thinking about racism, because that will force us to rethink how we're approaching, looking at and thinking about racism and how to deal with racism.
Have you, in the context of that kind of paradigm, Chris, mm-hmm. is the south of Ireland very different? I mean, I guess it is because the history is different and the demographics are different in terms of the lack of sectarianism in the same way as we see in the north, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, I guess, and I don't know, maybe this isn't something you've considered at all, just in terms of in the south of Ireland, we yeah. have probably slightly earlier, because you don't have the issue of the conflict in the south in the to the same extent as we have in Northern yeah. Ireland. We have immigrants arriving probably earlier, am I right? Like, you get them in the like mid to late 90s in the south, right? I think that we start seeing immigrants arriving to Ireland, whereas it's 5 or 6 years maybe later in Northern Ireland. But it's the same idea in terms of like places that didn't have significant numbers right. of immigrants, and then kind of quickly, suddenly, sizable numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's an important qualification, because there's always been immigration mm-hmm. into Ireland, mm-hmm. north and south. Mm-hmm. And Northern Ireland itself is a product of immigration from the Scots, Irish, mm-hmm. Ulster Scots, the plantations. So there's always been a history of immigration. There's a history in Northern Ireland of immigration from the 70s and the 80s. Paul Hainsworth edited a book in 1994, 1998, that looked at those histories of Pakistani migration into Northern Ireland, Chinese migration into Northern Ireland, and various different groups. But yeah, they were less than 1% of the population. So in terms, and their position in Northern Ireland was completely overshadowed by the troubles.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Republic of Ireland, again, there's immigration. There's like the Hungarian refugees that came in the 50s. But it isn't really till the Celtic Tiger that you get Ireland turning from a country of net emigration to a country of net immigration. And as someone who used to go from the north down to see my granny in Dublin in the 70s, to go to Dublin today, it's just such a different city now, and the immigrant population is a really significant part of the city. The most recent estimates I saw suggest that there's the foreign-born population is a higher proportion of the population of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, than it is of the UK okay. now. Right. Yeah, so that's really from a much lower base mm-hmm. over a very short mm-hmm. period of time. That's really remarkable. And you walk around Dublin, you hear all sorts of accents and language or languages being spoken, and people don't look typically Irish, well, whatever that is. My sense of it, and I'm not an expert on the South, is that. But some of the things that I've read is there's more hostility in the Republic towards people of colour, particularly Africans, than there is towards immigrants per se. And I find myself speaking to relatives, even speaking to older people that I know in the Republic, the way in which they talk about people of colour seems to me like I would have the kind of language and way people are thinking that I encountered in England in the 1970s, you just wouldn't encounter in England now. So in terms of attitudes, there's that. But the position of people of colour in the Republic of Ireland, I think, is closely related to immigration policy, asylum policy, the use of direct provision, the way in which people of African descent are actually physically marginalised and segregated from the rest of society. So I think it's not simply or straightforwardly, it's a colour racism. It's something that's reinforced by government policy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there, since the book has come out, you've had enough? Too often I'm speaking to someone right after a book has come out, and it's very hard to get any sense of the reception of it because it's too close. But this is out now a year and a half or so, or
it
over
is,
a year.
Yeah.
So, what has surprised you in terms of feedback with what you've put forward in the book?
Yeah, one of the things that's in a way surprised me, maybe it's more disappointed me, is that the book hasn't really been picked up by scholars in England and Scotland, anti-racist scholars. But in a way that affirms one of the central theses of the book, which is that Northern Ireland is treated as a place apart, and that the way in which racism and anti-racism has been thought about in England or in Britain is by excluding Northern Ireland from the thinking.
So would I be correct in saying, Chris, like in broad terms, I get the view in terms of Northern Ireland is, that's a separate beast because of the history and because of the sectarianism and et cetera, et cetera. Is that, am I interpreting you correctly?
Yeah.
Right. So failing to see actually the continuities or the possibly what you contend in terms of foreshadowing or kind of a sense of what was to come in terms of the English context more generally.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's one thing. And then the other thing that surprised me actually is it's not really been picked up by Northern Ireland scholars. That one did surprise me. I don't really know why not. I could only speculate about why not. It's interesting, the book's had two reviews. One by an American scholar in a publication that's not an Irish publication, and by a Austrian postgraduate student in a publication that's not a UK-based or Irish-based publication. So it seems to be the book is had been picked up and had more interest outside the British Isles than inside the British Isles, which I don't know what's going on there.
But Chris, is some of that, or is this, completely off the wall? Is in just in the noise and uncertainty and the whole context of Brexit and everything, mm-hmm. and all the conversations that are actually implicit, or I think you can learn so much from this book, right? That maybe is just possibly the timing as well is a challenge in terms of just literally all the noise right now and over the last year and a half ago and the uncertainty or surrounding Brexit. I don't know.
Yes.
What do you think?
There's certainly a lot of confusion and noise around Brexit. That's definitely the case. But there's also actually been some English scholars taking an interest in Northern Ireland, because one of the things that's become clear after the referendum is that Northern Ireland is key to whether Brexit is going to happen or not happen. The issue of the Irish backstop is something that's exercising a lot of scholars, and in that context I would have actually expected scholars to say, well, what are the books out there, what can we have a look at that will help us to make sense of this?
Are you speaking about this on your trip here to New York, Chris? Are you going to be talking about this research?
No, this is why I'm really pleased to have this opportunity from you. What I'm speaking about is about Brexit.
Okay. Yeah. Everyone's crazy these days. Yeah. Well, I'm only too delighted, not that I'm uninterested in Brexit, but this is a very important topic, and something I look forward to reading in terms of an intervention in the field. And I hope that for anyone who's interested, again, the title of the book is Northern Ireland and the Crisis of Anti-Racism, Rethinking Racism and Sectarianism, and it's published by Manchester University Press. And thank you, Chris Gilligan, for coming in to talk to us about it, and don't be a stranger. I hope we'll see you here again. Thanks very much,
Chris. Miriam, thank you.
And that was Chris Gilligan speaking about his book, Northern Ireland and the Crisis of Anti-Racism. Next week.